Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to Through the Smoke. This is Radio at Firehouse.com. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. It's been a few weeks since we've talked on the show. We're glad everybody's back with us. We do want to thank the folks at First Responders Financial, who provide financial services exclusively for first responders. And if the names Dennis Smith and Pete Hayden mean anything to you, it's because Dennis Smith is the founder and CEO of First Responder Financial, and Pete Hayden, vice chairman of First Responders Financial, both retired New York City firefighters. Pete most recently retired as a New York City Fire Department Chief of Department, and Dennis, of course, a well-known firefighter who started Firehouse Magazine, Firehouse.com, wrote Engine Company 82, and many, many other books. So again, we sure appreciate their support and sponsorship of the show and their support to firefighters and all first responders. And we'll have more about the services they provide in the coming days. Before I go any further in this week's show, I want to just pass on our deepest condolences to the family of Chief John Eversole. John was a listener of this show, a longtime friend of ours, and in all intent and purposes, as far as I'm concerned, our nation's and perhaps the world's hazmat chief. John passed away a few days ago. He was a veteran firefighter with over 30 years in the Chicago Fire Department. He retired as district chief of special functions, which is special operations, I guess, for the CFD. John led the shaping of legislation, trends, laws, and operations impacting the fire service, particularly in the areas of hazmat, firefighter safety, and terrorism. John had often been called to testify before congressional committees on so many issues related to the above. Quite frankly, and more important, John was a great man, truly a consummate gentleman, and a fire officer in the highest order. He was a very proud husband, dad, and most recently, he took on the rank of grandpa. If you ever had the pleasure to meet John, you know what I mean. And you two were very, very lucky. Again, we're sure going to miss John Eversole. God bless you, John, and thanks all you did. Thanks for all you did for all of us. And we'll dedicate the show to John. This week I've got a couple guests with us on the show, and I'm going to go to headlines in just a minute. But just to let you know, we've got Chief Greg Cade, the brand new United States Fire Administrator. We've got Chief Alan Schumann, the Georgia State Fire Marshal. We've got Captain Sean DeCrane. Sean's a captain with the Cleveland, Ohio Fire Department and is very involved in the residential sprinkler issue. And we're all going to talk about that whole issue, what happened up in Rochester, New York, how it impacts you as a firefighter and us in the future. So we'll get to that in just a little while. We're also going to have a little discussion with Chief Cade as our new fire administrator to see what he's got and planned or what he's got planned for us. The stand down is just a few weeks away. If you're not familiar with that, click on the link down below, www.ifc.org/standdown. And basically, we're building on the momentum of the National Firefighter Safety Standdowns in 05 and 06. The IFC, the IFF, and nearly all other fire service organizations have mutually called for another needed standdown that's going to be held on June 17th to the 23rd in just a few weeks. Fire departments and EMS agencies are urged to plan and participate in the event, but your personal help is needed. You need to carry this mission on at your firehouse. The focus this year is ready to respond, and that means a whole lot of stuff as far as the focus of the stand down. For example, before the run, what does your organization do to plan and be ready to respond? What do you do when you are responding? What about driving? That sort of issues like seatbelts. I'm going to talk about some crashes in just a minute. What are your plans on arrival? Basically, from start to finish, is your organization ready to respond? And is your readiness to respond focused on the ability of firefighters not to get themselves unnecessarily hurt and unnecessarily killed? Now, when I say unnecessarily, if you obviously know by listening to the show in the past, we do believe that every once in a while, firefighters do have to give their lives. We're in the business of risk-taking. The issue is, what risks are we taking? When there's clearly a life to be saved, there's no question that we have to get in there if there's an opportunity to try and save a life. Sometimes there's no opportunity, but so many other line-of-duty deaths are non-heroic. Clearly, all firefighters lead heroic lives, and we could talk about that all day long. But the way we lose our lives sometimes is so non-heroic, sometimes it's downright embarrassing, and there's so many things we can do to avoid that. So participate in the ISC stand-down, the National Firefighter Safety Stand-Down, coordinated by the IASC staff and the IASC Safety Health and Survival Section. Again, check the link below. The information's down there. Get involved. I've got Chief Schumann on with us, from who is the Georgia State Fire Marshal. And, Alan, I'm just going to mention our deepest condolences to the Georgia Fire Service, and in particular the Fulton County Fire Service, and especially the family of Firefighter Felix Roberts, who died last week on Memorial Day when attempting to do a search for a man that was trapped in that house. Chief, any comments on that fire that you can share with us? I know you were on the scene and that you are part of the investigation process.
Billy, it was a devastating fire to begin with, with loss of civilian. Also, when these firefighters tried to make a heroic entry into the home, like you said earlier, our condolences go out to the family of the fire service that we all have, that's very close to us, and his own personal family. This Felix was a honored veteran of the military and an honored veteran of the fire service. Several things that we have to look at, and we're going to continue to look at and get to the bottom of, and we're going to all work together to get there.
Thank you, Chief. We appreciate your update on that. And for those that have the opportunity to who attend the funeral, this is being recorded on Friday. The funeral is tomorrow. So for those of you that did have the opportunity to attend, I know that that all the people involved certainly appreciate you taking the time to go honor firefighter Felix Roberts, from the age 41, from the Fulton County Fire Department. Some good news, and we don't have a lot of good news sometimes in the stuff that we do on this show. A Hamilton, Ohio firefighter who nearly died during a training exercise is going home today. He is being taken home by fire apparatus. He's walking, he's talking, he's laughing, he's joking, and absolutely unbelievable. Firefighter Chris Gabbard was seriously injured on April 17th during a water rescue exercise on the Great Miami River. His boat was drawn into a low dam and overturned, and firefighter Gabbard remained underwater trapped for nearly 20 minutes. Clearly a miracle, and we're sure glad to hear about firefighter Gabbard's recovery and the fact that he is on his way home. We're not going to spend a lot of time on it because you can do the research yourself, but the apparatus crashes continue to be significant. There's been some very serious crashes, one in particular in Connecticut, where firefighters lost their life there. There was a tanker crash, again, down in the south. And what we're going to do to save time is we have the links below. I don't know what we can do to get the folks listening to the show or to the folks involved in the fire service, but we've got to slow down, we've got to stop at intersections, and we've got to wear our seatbelts. We understand the seatbelt is a hassle when you're putting your gear on, but man, oh man, there's got to be a better way. So our condolences to the folks in Connecticut and some of the other areas that have Kansas. I know we had one there recently. It just continues. We had a very serious crash in Pennsylvania where a responding ladder truck hit a wall. You know, we want to go to fires. We love going to fires. I mean, let's face it, that's what we do. It's what we enjoy doing, and it's our pride and pleasure to serve. But if we don't get there, forget it. The rest of it doesn't matter. Just recently, a report came out related to the city of Baltimore. If you recall, we've talked about this on a show before. A firefighter recruit was killed. Rachel Wilson was killed earlier this year. And I wanted to share with you some parts that have been extracted from the article, and we'll have a link to the actual article here on the show. But a Baltimore Fire Department panel has recommended that two more city firefighters be fired from their jobs because of their roles in that February 9th training burn in a row house that killed firefighter recruit Rachel Wilson and injured two others. One of the two, Lieutenant Barry Broyles, responded that the Baltimore Fire Department never followed safety standards during live burns, and they should not have hired the recruit who died. Broyles and Crest, another fire officer involved in this, appeared last week before a panel of their peers who recommended termination. Broyles, 32 years on the job, said his actions do not merit dismissal, and he is flabbergasted. Crest, with the Baltimore Fire Department for 26 years, says he does accept some responsibility for mistakes, but does not think he should be fired. Interestingly, neither firefighter knew about the panel's recommendations until they were called by a news media reporter. A preliminary investigation by the Baltimore Fire Department, if you recall, found 36 violations of the NFPA safety standards that oversees training burns. The department claims they followed it. Steve Fugate, a captain with the Baltimore Fire Department and president of the Fire Officers Union, said that any move to dismiss these members is premature. Although firefighters are barred by department rules from speaking to a reporter without permission, Broyles gave an on-the-record interview and said that the training exercise that killed recruit firefighter Rachel Wilson was similar to other live burns that he has helped run. Broyles said the department always sets multiple fires at exercises, and at least one on the first floor and one on the second floor. Here's a quote from the media article. I've yet to see a live burn where anyone followed 1403, referring to the NFPA standard that governs that. He says, I have yet to see a live burn anywhere that followed 1403. If you're going to follow 1403 100%, you will send people out there into the field who are not prepared to fight fire, end quote. So that certainly is worthy of discussion at a later date. The lieutenant also blamed the Baltimore Fire Department's lax hiring practices for hiring Wilson. Quote, she should never have been hired in the first place. She worked in the fire marshal's office. She really wasn't cut out for this job. Wilson's family says she always dreamed of being a firefighter and was in good physical condition. Another quote from the lieutenant, Broyles, the bottom line is she panicked, she pulled her face piece off. If she hadn't done that, it would have been just another training day and things would have gone on. Well, you know what? I didn't hear the quote, but I'm going to comment with the assumption that the quote is accurate. That's why we have fire instructors. That's why she's called a recruit. Recruits are expected to do things. That's why we keep instructors with them. So we'll be watching to see what happens as the days go on and as this report unfolds more and more of what's happened in Baltimore City. But it's a reminder to any of us and all of us in the business, a recruit, a probie, whatever you want to call it, is the intense responsibility of any fire officer. When you breathe, they breathe. When you move, they move. And really, until they're fully qualified, trained, and set out into the field, they're not qualified to do anything on their own, and constant supervision is required. And then once they get out into the field, the lieutenant, the captain, whoever the company officer is responsible to keep that probie or rookie with you at all times until you feel they're ready to move forward. So we wish the best to everyone involved in Baltimore's situation, hoping that the truth will continue to come out. But also, man, oh man, there's a whole lot for us to learn about as time goes on. This is Radio at Firehouse.com. You're listening to Through the Smoke. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. We're going to be back in just a minute with Chief Greg Cade, the new United States Fire Administrator. And right after that, we're going to have a lively discussion on the issues of residential sprinklers.
Welcome to the latest edition of Through the Smoke with Deputy Fire Chief Billy Goldfeder, addressing issues impacting all firefighters' safety, health, and morale.
We're back. This is Through the Smoke Radio at Firehouse.com. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. This show is brought to you by First Responders Financial. Check out the website. Not only do we use them as a sponsor, but I'm a customer as well. I urge you as a firefighter to check out the services available to you from First Responders Financial. Well, next on the show, we've got an old friend of mine, old as in long-term friendship, not in age, Chief Greg Cade. Greg was voted unanimously by the U.S. Senate last week, confirmed as nominated by President Bush as our new United States Fire Administrator. Greg will be starting as the new United States Fire Administrator on July 1st. He's got 40 years in the fire service. He's a longtime member of the IFC. Greg has spent the last 8 years serving as fire chief and emergency service coordinator for Virginia Beach, Virginia. There are 19 station departments, several hundred members. In addition, he's also been involved with the National Urban Search and Rescue Team Advisory Board. Let's see, Greg, you started, I guess. Well, first of all, welcome. Welcome to Through the Smoke, and welcome to your new job.
Well, thank you very much, Billy. It's a pleasure.
Let's see, you're a graduate University of Maryland in College Park with a BA in Fire Administration, 2001, Harvard University Program for Senior Executives program. You actually started with the Prince George's County Fire Department. Well, you started there as a career volunteer firefighter chief.
I started there as a volunteer in 1968 in Glendale, Station 18.
Were you responsible for their trucks being yellow? Was that your decision?
Actually, I got there when they bought the first yellow one.
So. Well, you certainly can tell when it's Glendale's equipment on the scene. So you started there as a volunteer, and what drove you to become a career firefighter, and how'd you end up in the PG as opposed to somewhere else, maybe?
Probably at the time, just a young kid looking for something to do, and the county was getting ready to hire firefighters, and I said, hey, you know, here's an opportunity to get to do something and earn a paycheck that I enjoy doing every day just for free as a volunteer. And luckily for me, I was in the career recruit class number one, so the first one that the county hired.
No kidding. Now, you went on, became a career firefighter, and you retired there as Bureau Chief of Fire Suppression, is that correct?
Yeah, I was in charge of the field when I left.
Okay, and then when you left there, you went to the city of Hampton, Virginia. That was in 92?
Yeah, I was very lucky to be selected, gave my first chief's job there, and what a great city, and they gave me the opportunity to be the chief there for six wonderful years.
Then Virginia Beach. Now, Virginia Beach, now Hampton, was that a primarily a career department, 100% career department?
No, it was a combination department.
Okay.
Like Virginia Beach is and Prince George's County. So, yeah, my whole fire service career has always been in a combination department.
That's kind of where I was going. I knew that Virginia Beach, you have a pretty, you've got some still some pretty strong volunteer members there and still very active within your service.
Yeah.
And with your new role as fire administrator, that's interesting that, you come from a volunteer background, and you've worked with volunteer firefighters and career union firefighters pretty much your entire career. Now, I think that brings a lot to the table. So let's carry that discussion on. I'll turn it over to you. What are your plans? What are your thoughts? What do you want to get done?
Well, I mean, obviously, I've only got 18 months in this job. It lasts until the Bush administration goes out in January of 2009, so it's probably not a lot of time to do a bunch of things. But Billy, as you know, one of the most important things in my fire service career and one of the issues that I've pushed for a long, long time has been firefighter safety. I've been very actively involved with the IAFC firefighter safety topics. We were one of the pilot programs for the near-miss reporting program. God, I hate to think of how many committees I've served on with
you. Well, you and I worked together prior to the IFC Safety Health and Survival Section.
Oh, yeah,
you were an
sure.
active member
when
of the
it was
safety.
A, when it was an extremely small committee.
Committee with not a whole lot of interest.
No.
And
but,
now we're approaching almost 1,000 members in that section.
I know. I'll tell you, that is just something I sit and marvel at and just, you know, how tremendous that is. But, you know, the previous administrator and the current acting administrator, both Charlie Dickerson, who let me say has done an outstanding job of running that place for the last couple of years. And,
absolutely.
And Dave Paulison before him. They were, you know, they've been focused on the 16 initiatives out of the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation, and David Paulison's, you know, proposal to reduce the number of firefighter deaths by 50%. And my intent when I get there is to find out where we are along that continuum. You know, how close are we? What are the programs that are out there that are in place, and how well are they working? And what can I do as an advocate to try and make it better? You know, we're in a dangerous business, as you had said earlier, but boy, I still think we're losing people that we shouldn't lose.
No, without question, Chief. Yeah. You know, we look at about 100 deaths or so a year, take 50% away from medical reasons and heart attacks, and if you narrow those down, just of those 50, half are smokers. I'm not going to get on the bandwagon on that, but it's a fact.
Yeah,
and
okay.
Then so I mean, you dig into those numbers, and you find out at the end that very, very few of those were not predictable. Now you look at the trauma side, and you know, 20-something percent of the trauma side are related to vehicular accidents, and they're all preventable. then there's the building construction issues. I mean, we're going to get into that in a few minutes when we talk about sprinklers. But as we've been saying, this ain't your daddy's fire. Your daddy responded to a brick house with a solid wood roof that if it was burning for a while, we could predict what was going to happen.
Right.
We could predict today, too. It's going to happen a whole hell of a lot quicker. And so the challenges we have today, so when you're looking at those numbers, Chief, not only look at the fact that understanding that, you know, all firefighters, and certainly you are one, and you are the number one now in the nation, do heroic stuff, but man, we do some stupid stuff. And whatever you can do to help get that point across of the slowing down to wear the seatbelts. I mean, I had an email written to me just recently suggesting that the NFPA or whoever come up with a policy or a law, tankers no longer be considered emergency vehicles. I mean, there's enough frustration out there with people getting slung out of these rigs. I mean, if you saw one in, I guess, Alan, was it Alabama 2 weeks ago? It was a tractor-trailer military tanker. It was like almost 30 years old. And I mean, these guys were responding to a fire in a 30-year-old tanker that wasn't designed to haul water.
And probably wasn't designed to respond as an emergency vehicle.
Yeah, yeah. And it just doesn't seem to make sense that, you know, and let me just toss one at you also. If you're going to be looking at the programs, look at the Fire Act grant program. We love the program. It's a big deal for us. But there are some communities that are getting grant after grant, and there's other communities that just can't seem to get a grant because they don't have anybody on their organization that's skilled at grant writing. I don't want to put you in a corner, but I think it's a real issue.
Well, and I don't disagree with you, Billy. I mean, it was certainly an issue that was raised at my Senate hearing before the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee. I mean, those senators are extremely interested in trying to find out why some people are successful and others, you know, that truly have the same need aren't being successful. And, you know, we certainly here in Virginia Beach, I mean, in the interest of full disclosure, 5 out of 6 years, so... we've done very well, but we are involved in grants on a regular basis too.
Sure.
And I think, and that makes a difference. And hopefully, some of the programs, and I know the United States Fire Administration does offer, along with the IEFC, classes on, you know, how to write grants and how to do a better job. I mean, I know. We're getting, you know, 20, I think it was 22,000 applications this year. So, I mean, there's a lot of need out there. There is absolutely no question about that. But we've got to make sure that the people that have the greatest need are getting the money.
Yeah. Well, and nothing against a department that's been successful, clearly. I mean, nobody should suffer because they did it right and were awarded. But I know that in so many areas, and I tend to think in places like where Alan works, where he's got some large metropolitan departments there in Georgia or even up in the Cleveland, Ohio area, but go 30, 40 miles outside of Metro City, and you've got guys operating on a $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 a year budget trying to provide fire protection. And
well,
the
I went
community...
up...
Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say, I went up and actually reviewed grants in 2003, I think it was. And when you read some of those applications, I mean, it just broke your heart for guys, you know, that were operating fire departments on $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 a year, and there's no way in God's green acre that they were ever going to be able to afford a couple $100,000 fire truck. I mean, it just, you know, I mean, there's no way, absolutely no way.
Well, whatever you can do to look at that, and it sounds like you're focused on that. That sure is appreciated. I know that,
yeah.
Chief. So what else you got planned? 18 months, you know, that didn't even dawn on me.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you've got one heck of a lot to do in 18 months. You know, I've always been one to say, and since as I've gotten older and gotten to learn about the workings of government and all, I really kind of feel that the U.S. Fire Administrator position is really what the Fire Service, the FEMA Director, which of course is Dave, and you, meaning our new administrator, wants that position to be. And in this case, with FEMA Director Chief Dave Paulson, former fire chief, and given your background, I think, you know what, this is a home run here that, you know, you can pick up a lot of what Charlie's done. Charlie's done some incredible stuff. He's really raised the visibility of the position and what the United States Fire Administration does. Any other thoughts on things you'd like to do or what you'd like to hear from, or are you going to be attending some of the conferences? Are we going to see you around?
You are definitely going to see me around. I mean, one of the things that I know I need to do is to reach out to all of these organizations and listen to what the people have to say that are, you know, I mean, I told the Senate and everyone else, you know, I come with frontline street level experience. That's who I am. I mean, you know,
right.
That's my whole background. And I want to make sure that as I come in there and try and be a voice for the fire service at the federal level, that I understand exactly, you know, what it is that they need. I think one of the other critical issues that I see is some way of improving and utilizing our data capabilities. I've used this before. When you look at the our brethren in the police department, you know, they can give you the statistical evaluation of changing the color of their socks and how it affects
the
crime rate. You know, and we can all laugh about that, but you know, they've got somebody out there who's figured it out, and we need to have that kind of data capability. And it's got to be current, it's got to be quick, and we've got to have people at the fire service level who can use it and use it effectively. And we're going to talk about sprinklers in a little while. That, to me, is a classic example of it. I mean, we've got the data to prove what's going on. How do we lose that in the argument?
Yeah, it's nothing new. That applies to a lot of stuff, whether it be how we're losing our firefighters or how we're getting hurt or as you just mentioned.
Right. I do know there is certainly as much as as our friends in Congress and love the fire service, and they certainly do, you know, they've got to answer for the money they're giving us, and they want to know, you know, are we getting a good return on our investment? I think they are. I don't think there's any question about that. But, you know, you've still got to be able to put the numbers in front of them.
How do we, Gary Breese said that actually on this show. Clearly we know it, but how do we prove it? What has the Fire Act Grant Program done? How has it reduced injury? How has it reduced death? How has it reduced fires? And we know it has, but we need to be able to prove that it has. That's an interesting challenge right there you're going to have. You know, one more thing that somebody tossed my way recently was, you know, communication. The police departments across this nation have one way to communicate amongst each other, and that's the NCIC program, where there's a computer in every little police station, whether it's a little podunk town or it's a big metropolitan area,
right,
where the police are able to communicate information real well. Someone suggested maybe that become a program at some point, and I thought it was a great idea. If there was one single way for your office, the United States Fire Administration, to send safety bulletins out to every fire station in the nation, of what's gone on here, how this can be improved, safety recall information, hey, this air pack's a problem, or these pass alarms aren't working. And, I don't know what it would cost or anything like that, but that certainly could then better facilitate communications and almost have like a little daily news that goes out to fire departments across the nation. I don't know if you've ever given any thought to that.
Well, I have, and I know the U.S. Fire Administration is working on revamping the old ENET program into
right,
their new one called PrepNet, and that's kind of the basis of, you know, what they're looking to be able to do is to have that kind of instant communication capability and be able to get the messages out right away to the whole fire service. But you're right. I mean, when you look at how the police department's able to do that, I mean, you know, the FBI years and years and years ago was able to get the money to build that network. And I don't know that the U.S. Fire Administration can do that, but maybe there's some other technology ways of getting the same result, utilizing maybe a few different methods. There's some creative people at the USFA, and I'm lucky to have opportunity to be up there and bring these kinds of issues and find out how do we get it done.
And we're lucky to have you on board. It was exciting to hear of your nomination and 18 months. That's good and bad. I mean, 18 months, you know, how bad, no matter how bad it goes, you know you're done in 18 months, I guess, is one positive way.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know. And
are you getting a mobile home, or are you going to actually live somewhere up there?
No, I'm actually going to live in the Washington, D.C. area. I'm going to keep my house here in Virginia Beach at least through this. But yeah, I'll,
certainly the possibility of you retaining the position after exists, I guess, right?
Absolutely, you know. Yeah. But you know, who won't know that, I guess, until November of 2008, when you know, when the election is done. And
interesting elections coming up, no question. Chief, no, any final words for our listeners?
Well, nothing. Just the biggest thing is I'm going to need their support and advice. I mean, as I'm only one person, and I certainly don't have all the answers, but I do know that they're out there. We got a ton of talented people in this fire service and the career and volunteer side, so I intend to tap into them and use them.
Outstanding.
Starting with
congratulations.
You. Oh, thank you, Billy.
Here we go. Yeah, again, congratulations, Chief Greg Cade. We're going to be back in just one second. We're going to be talking with Chief Cade, Chief Alan Schumann, the Georgia State Fire Marshal, and Captain Sean DeCrane from the Cleveland Fire Department, who also represents the IFF in relations to the residential sprinkler issues and the smacking and the beating we're taking on it and how we're not going to take it anymore. We'll be right back.
Is it sometimes a little hard to see through the smoke? Do fire service, rescue, and EMS issues work you up just a bit? Maybe more than just a bit? If they don't, check your pulse. It's normal for firefighters and responders to get worked up over hot issues when you love the job so much. Deputy Fire Chief Billy Goldfeder, Firehouse.com commentator and Firehouse Magazine columnist, hosts Through the Smoke, an internet broadcast and podcast that addresses issues impacting all firefighters, such as safety, health, and morale. Don't ignore the issues and maintain the status quo. Take an interest in issues that impact you, the frontline responder. Join Billy, special guests, and firefighters around the country and the world regularly on Through the Smoke, only on Firehouse.com.
We're back. This is Through the Smoke, radio at Firehouse.com. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder, and we're being hosted by First Responders Financial. The residential sprinkler issue. Well, before we get into that, again, I'm going to welcome back Chief Greg Cade, our new U.S. Fire Administrator. Thanks for being with us, Chief.
Thank you, Billy.
Captain Sean DeCrane. Sean is a 16-year veteran of the Cleveland, Ohio Fire Department. He's captain assigned to the Training Academy and has a responsibility preparing the continuous education aspects for the Cleveland Fire Academy. Sean has served as a union rep in Local 93 in the past and is currently representing the IFF nationally or internationally in the 2007 edition of the International Code Council. Welcome, Sean.
Thanks for having me here, Bill.
It's a pleasure to have you involved in this. I know this is something you're very passionate about. And last but certainly not least, an old friend and an incredible advocate for the fire service nationally, but particularly in the state of Georgia, is Georgia State Fire Marshal Chief Alan Schumann. Alan's got 30 years from firefighter to company officer to chief. He was appointed Georgia's Chief State Fire Marshal in January of 2000. He serves on several regional and state fire associations and is currently the Vice President of the National Association of State Fire Marshals. Alan, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Billy. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Well, you know, the fire service was not successful this time in being able to produce the majority vote needed to, or the majority two-third vote, needed to obtain approval of public comment number one to make residential sprinklers part of the code. We had a majority in the initial vote to defeat the committee's recommendation, but we were only able to muster a majority of about 55 to 45 for the motion to modify with comment one. Reports from Rochester, New York, and I'm going to let our guests tell you about that last week, is that we had an equal split of people at the conference voting between builders, building officials, and the fire protection industry. So it was tough for us as a fire service to reach a two-third vote threshold. But in the words of one United States Fire Administration official, wow, what a national effort it was. And although it didn't pass this time, the efforts for next year are already underway, and we're going to share that information in just a few minutes. You know, we spoke to several firefighters who were in Rochester last week, and they advised that one problem is fire people who spoke against residential sprinklers. Naturally, those folks who do that have alternative personal and selfish needs. Sure, this is a free country, but when we look deep to find out why, the facts come out. Heck, there was one fire district in Missouri that actually passed a resolution against residential sprinklers. This fire district board of directors issued a resolution formally opposing mandatory fire sprinklers in new residential one- and two-story new residential one and two family houses. This makes me nuts. You can hear me stuttering. In addition to opposing it, we've been advised that these fire district board of directors have also urged their fire district's delegates, I can see career dissipation lights going off on this one, to vote against all proposals related to the matter while in attendance at the meetings in Rochester last week or any other meetings the ICC has. It was reported that the local home builders association in the St. Louis area, their members and their political action committee, has given thousands of dollars to the campaign of the current fire district board members in recent elections there in Melville, Missouri. That same board also voted to eliminate the district's fire inspections on all new residential one and two family homes, or pre-CO inspections, it looks like, as well. Reminder, who is a fire district board? What are they supposed to do? They're supposed to look out for the fire service. I know I fantasize a lot, but I don't know where you come from, but in my silly world, fire board directors, commissioners, chiefs, trustees are supposed to look out what's best for citizens and firefighters from a fire protection standpoint. Supposed to do whatever it takes to prevent or put out fires. It's a simple mission, but boy, did they screw it up. Another question might be that perhaps the reason some, quote, home building people and their closest of bedroom buddies across the USA fight against residential sprinklers because of the value of a house that burns down. Now think about that. Houses burn down, somebody makes money building a new house. See, when a house burns down, it gets rebuilt. If houses get sprinklered, they won't burn down, but there'll still be a loss to the builders. They won't make money if the house doesn't burn down. There's the financial issue. It's a financial loss to them. You see, they push the issue of using smoke detectors. That way they try to sleep at night knowing people might get out when the detectors sound. But the house is still burning, but then they get to rebuild it. Nifty. Risk to firefighters operating interior to lightweight wood truss involved house searching for kids? Nah, they would respond, that's a firefighter's job. Well, you know what? They're screwed up. They're lost, they're confused, and we're going to have to change their opinions. Prince William County, Virginia. Young firefighter recently died in a lightweight wood truss house. Building was not sprinklered. Fulton County, Georgia. Young firefighter died. Lightweight wood truss house, non-sprinklered. He died unnecessarily. Certainly he died heroically, but if the house was sprinklered, odds are he'd still be with us today. Forget the good stuff in that house, like your kids, your grandkids, your parents, you know, the people whose pictures are on your desk and your wallet or on your walls. The issue is the value of rebuilding a house. It's a multi-billion dollar industry, and that's what we're up against next year. We got beat this year, but you know what? We bruised them pretty good. We did pretty well this year. Wait till next year. And that's what we're going to talk about now. So I'm going to toss this discussion over to our friends that have joined us today. I'm going to start with Chief Alan Schumann, who's intimately involved in this. And quite frankly and sadly, Alan is the state fire marshal in our country that most recently responded to a firefighter line-of-duty death that occurred in a building that could have been sprinklered. Chief Schumann, how about some comments?
Well, first of all, Billy, thanks for letting me come on today and speak to you about this. We did bruise them in Rochester, New York, during the final action hearings there. One thing that I have to ask myself when I'm watching the votes go down is the fire service community, are we all on the same page? The short answer to that was no, standing there. And that's something that we're going to all have to work on. The fire service community has got to come together. We've got to be at the same place at the same time at the table for some sound discussions regarding the issues brought forward during those hearings, Billy. We were being slammed by things like, well, what are those folks that have wells in the back of their homes? How are we going to sprinkle their homes when they build a new home? We were tossed out cost factors, code trade-offs, many other items. And, of course, the political hurdles at the state and local levels. Those are things that we have got to, as the fire service, come together and redirect, at least get everyone on the same page.
Who's going to take the lead on this? I mean, we really need a band leader. Maybe, you know, what organization, what association, where are we? Or, if multiple organizations are doing it, are we all communicating, or can we improve on that?
You know, Sean DeCrane here. I'll jump in on that.
Sure, Cap. Go ahead.
One of One of the things that we've been trying to do, and I've been working with Jack Murphy and also the National Association of State Fire Marshals and Kate Dargan, the State Fire Marshal from California, in Orlando we actually started having meetings at the back of the room and discussing the issues that were coming up. And we met prior to the hearings in Rochester, and I first have to say that Jeff Shapiro did a great job organizing a lot of the testimony to get the residential sprinklers. But we need to do a better job as a service of communicating with the various representatives within that service to coordinate our message and to make sure that our members are on board. Right before the vote, someone from California actually grabbed me and told me that a union rep had told her that the IFF was actively opposing the residential sprinkler issue. So I immediately called Rich Duffy, and you know, I didn't want to look like egg on the face when I stood at the microphone, and he reassured me. You know, he about flipped his lid because the IFF is very committed to this issue. You mentioned truss construction, but lightweight construction in general. Let's not forget the engineered wood products such as the lightweight I-beams that killed a Wisconsin firefighter.
Oh, yeah, they come right out. But Billy, the IRC Fire Sprinkler Coalition did a wonderful job with Chief Ronnie Coleman debunking the myths of a lot of what we heard testimony on in Rochester. I go back to the well issue. We went back to cost factors. Folks won't be able to afford to buy a home if we sprinkle them. I think we do have to come together as a fire community to address those issues so we're ready to defend those stances when we go back. Now, how do we get there? Right. We got to build a national strategy for this. We got 18 months to get this ready, actually less than that. We've got to build a strategy, a national fire service strategy for residential sprinkler systems to be installed. You know, taking it from the appendix into the main body is still that two-thirds majority vote we have to have at the final action hearings.
So, Greg, let's toss you into this pit.
Okay.
How can the United States Fire Administration, and under your leadership, maybe this might be Project One, I don't know, I mean, because this ties into the firefighter safety issue as much or more than any. We prevent fires, we don't have firefighter injury related to those fires. And Sean and Alan chime in, but Greg, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I certainly think that we need to make sure that we have a concerted effort on doing this. I mean, I agree with what was said before. It makes it look pretty hard for us to go in if some of us are not on board and are saying the exact opposite of what we're saying. I think that, you know, hopefully I know the United States Fire Administration is a strong proponent of residential sprinklers, and hopefully maybe we can help with the education side of things for the fire service and bring out some more of, you know, of these facts of what's taking place that's killing our firefighters. I mean, you know, as you said, I mean, I've been in the fire service 40 years, and certainly fighting house fires today is a significant difference from when it was when I started. I can remember the first time I saw plywood I-beams. I was still an engine company officer working in Bowie, and we actually, it was a Christmas Eve, we had a windstorm blow through there, and it blew the center sections of these townhouses down that were using plywood I-beams because they were just, you know, they were still under construction, so they were just field, you know, put together. And I looked at this thing, and I called our fire marshal's office, and I said, man, it's got to be illegal to use these things. They
right.
had a 35-foot I-beam, and you could pick it up with one guy in the center
sure.
and hold it up over his head. You know, and you know, the ends of the board were still on the ground because it was flexed so much. And I called Dave Banworth, who was a fire protection engineer at the time in PG County. I said, Dave, these things have got to be illegal. They can't, you know, this. And he's, you know, well, obviously they're not.
Yeah.
But how they burn in a fire is significantly different. And you know, I mean, you can argue all day long about, well, you know, we won't have fires and that'll solve the problem. That the data doesn't support that.
No, but you know, I want to tie it into something else, though, and this definitely goes against the grain of so many people. But there's at some point, when do we say we're not? I mean, without using it as a scare tactic, but as Sean mentioned earlier, how important the numbers are. the fact of the matter is that when we pull up, and we'll certainly watch to see the report come out of Fulton County, but my initial reports were that there was heavy involvement in the back of this house. And if we arrive with an army, it may have led to the death of a firefighter because of the lack of any sprinklers and due to the construction.
Right.
But at some point, do we tell our communities, tell the public, look, we can't, if we've got this much involvement, you may have 10 babies and orphans hanging out the windows, but we may not be able to do anything but toss a ladder up to them. And I'm, look, I mean, most of you know me pretty well. I got all kinds of old gear and love going to calls and going to fires and getting in there, and I'm still doing it. But, man, at some point, when can we not just be so reactive and simply respond and say, look, in this case, we can't go in. We just can't do it. I mean, Sean, a comment from you. You're a line firefighter.
Well, you know, recently...
Or fire captain, I apologize.
And, the chief mentioned numbers and data, and we have to educate our own numbers. Recently, we did something down here in Cleveland with our turnout care, and the chief wanted a 20-minute presentation. Where do you come up with 20 minutes on turnout care? But, you know, we went and looked at, NFPA did a study from 1977 to 1997 on firefighter fatalities. And they looked in the 1970s compared to the 1990s. And actually, the firefighter deaths per incident stayed relatively the same. So they went a little bit deeper into the numbers, and what they found that firefighter deaths from heart attacks actually decreased from, I believe, 2.6 to 1.9 per 100,000 structure fires or 100,000 incidents. And then, but they looked at the traumatic deaths, and the traumatic deaths from smoke inhalation, burns, or internal injuries went from 1.8 in 1970s to 3 per 100,000 structure fires in the 1990s. So the fireplace is actually becoming, the fire ground is becoming a much more dangerous place. Yes, we are losing 100 firefighters a year, but we're not having the same number of structure fires we did at one time. So I don't believe our members are truly aware of those kinds of numbers. And those are the things that we have to get out to them, that with today's construction, and especially our turnout gear allowing us to go places, today's construction is more dangerous, and the contents of the buildings are making these fire grounds more dangerous. Our members need to be aware of that. We need to educate the public on that, too.
You know, and I'm not taking anything away. We're going to be brave. We are going to risk our lives. We're going to take those chances when we have good indication there's life to be saved,
right.
And I don't ever want to paint a portrait different than that. But, damn, at some point you just want to stomp your foot down and say, you know, you keep building this bullshit. It keeps catching on fire. There's no sprinkler systems. And then you're expecting us to run in there and make a difference. And at what point? And the point is now. The point is what we're talking about. The sprinkler issue, the construction issue, et cetera. And so how do we get that done, Sean, Greg, and Alan? How are we going to get the fire service to understand that we need to sing off one sheet of music on this issue? Well, what do we have? When's the next meeting? Palm Springs, right?
Correct. Yeah. February 17th.
Okay. Right.
When is it?
February 17th to March 2nd, 2008.
Okay, so we've got about a year and a half. No.
No, we have...
10 months.
We
the final well, the final action hearings won't be again till
September.
Yeah.
Okay. But we've got basically a year to get our shit together on this thing.
Well, I think I'm sorry to interrupt.
One
of the things we also have to do is educate our... There is a fear in some areas of the fire service that residential sprinklers will put us out of work.
Right.
And, you know, that's simply not true. We offer so many other services besides suppression that, you know... We're not going to go away, and we're not going to lose our jobs, or the fire service is never going to cease to be needed. And we're like, in my opinion, we're like any other business out there. We're offering a product for sale, and that is our services. And we need to adapt that product to the changing times. Now we're doing hazmat, we're doing technical rescues, medical responses. We're adapting to that time, and you know, we can't, as a fire service, be afraid that an innovative product such as residential sprinklers is going to take our services away, because it won't. We'll still be needed.
Billy?
Greg, Alan, go ahead. Then Greg, I want to go to you in a second after Alan, sure. Greg. Greg, what I'm going to ask you is about the mandatory residential sprinkler laws in Prince George's County, Maryland, for new construction.
Okay.
So we'll get back to that in a minute. Alan, Chief Schumann, go ahead.
Listen, I don't like to regress to when we wore our hip boots and our long coats and our plastic helmets, but You know, during those times, I think we were pushing something that was called a smoke detector, one for every home.
Yeah.
Then we decided with the data that we were collecting, those that were collecting data at the time, you know, we'd be better off if we had one on each floor of your home. Now we've gotten to the point where we recommend a photoelectric ionization, both, on each floor.
Right.
And it's taken us how long to do that?
Right, right.
Now, is this something that on a national strategy we sit down and look at this? We look at of maybe a per capita? Do we look at the square footage of the home? Do we look if we're sleeping above a garage or a kitchen? Do we have exceptions to the standards? This is something that has to be talked about in our fire community before we can walk out and say this is what we want. This is what we have to agree to.
It sounds to me that the IFC, the IFF, and the Fire Marshals Association are the absolute lead on this, being supported by the NFPA with data and things like that and all the other organizations.
And I'd wholeheartedly agree to that.
And Sean, I mean, I know you can't speak for the international, but on behalf of them, I mean, is it time for a, without abusing the word, an emergency summit? An emergency summit almost sponsored by the USFA. They host it. The IFF, the IFC, and the fire marshals attend and devise a plan. I mean, is it urgent time?
I personally would like to see that. And, you know, I have forwarded recommendations from the recent ICC hearings. And, you know, I'm sure they're discussing it in D.C., what their next step is and what steps to take. But I believe that would be a great step forward to organizing our response to the home builders.
I mean, I see nothing that would stop that. I mean, Chief Cade's office could find a facility. I mean, hell, we can go to a firehouse somewhere.
Yeah,
they can provide staff and data, and we inform the membership. I mean, I think this is a great opportunity. And if the home builders are listening, keep listening, pal. All right, Greg, talk to us about what you did in Prince George's County, Maryland, years ago.
Well, it was it probably started in the early 80s, right after we got mandatory smoke detectors. Billy, as you remember being around there in those days, we were doing a pretty darn good job of burning the county down on a regular basis. Lots and lots of fires. And that's how I learned how to do it. I went to them often. But, you know, we figured out there's got to be a better way. And in working with the building community, we got them, you know, with a lot of relationship building and everything
else.
Lots of lunches to agree to support mandatory residential sprinklers in any new construction in Prince George's County after, I think the law went into effect in 87 or 88, and you know, and after it went in, we had some townhouse fires where the residential sprinklers put the fire out, and in two cases that I can remember, the fire department was called when the people came back home and found out they'd had a fire and the sprinkler put it out.
Maryland certainly set the tone, and I'm guessing that Maryland's probably going to be the first state. Statewide at some point in a not-too-distant future where this is going to exist. Don't you think so?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I mean, and for anybody who goes on any of the websites in PG County, the guys are still going to calls. I mean, unfortunately
sure.
for the citizens, I mean, it hasn't quit responding on stuff. I mean, they're still going to over 100,000 calls a year, you know, combined of all kinds of different things. So, you know, even here in Virginia Beach, you know, our numbers of structure fires is pretty flat over the last 6-8 years. Our number of calls go up 8% a year.
Right.
So there's still plenty of work for us to do. People are still calling.
And Alan and Sean, you were both in Rochester. Greg, were you up there or you were tied up?
No, I was not. I was tied up
stuff
with,
last week. Okay. Alan and Sean, I want to talk about the dark stuff for a minute, the dark side. I was just absolutely blown away that there were fire service folks there speaking against it. What was their logic? Why are they so misinformed?
Alan, you want to take that first? Or?
Well, they've been brainwashed, Billy, and we're going to change them out of the dark side soon. Because I can't answer the question. I don't know if it's a political, it felt so political, Billy, that it was a local political issue, and they were sent there to stop the local political issue from raising its head. It was hard to get a grasp on exactly what side they really stood on, because as soon as you talk to them about it, they knew all the data about how smoke detectors have almost cut the fire death rate in residential home fires in half. They knew it all.
Right.
And you said, well, what about the guys going into those fires?
Right.
What about those, the other half? Here's the other half's solution, is the sprinklers.
Do you think it's just a sprinkling of the examples I gave of that outfit in Missouri? There's just a couple of them out there, and it's not as big a problem? Or is it like politics, it's a local problem, and we've got to give the local fire chiefs the ammunition information to solve that problem?
I agree with your last statement. I think we have to get the local fire chiefs on board with this, and we have to give them the ammunition, resources, and the words of encouragement to come along.
And
Sean?
One of the big things, I think that they're getting local pressure because the home builders have done, you know, they've done a good job in their aspect of pushing the economic impact that might have on their community. So maybe as a fire service, we need to really get the information out that this is, does not have an adverse economic impact on your community to require fire sprinklers.
Billy,
they were
at one time talking that your new water connection for that to run your sprinkler would cost $13,000 added to your home cost. Billy, they were talking about when one head goes off, they all go off. It's the same myth we've been hearing about for 15 years.
Right. So we've got a real challenge ahead of us, and maybe that summit can be pulled off where we put together some documentation, we create an education package for a fire chief and for city managers and for elected officials with the facts. I mean, as Sean, that's what you said from the beginning. It's about the numbers. We got to give them the numbers. And the numbers equate to dollars, and anybody in this business more than 10 minutes knows it's all about the dollars. I mean, the cost of firefighting, the cost of firefighters, cost of fire equipment, the cost of homes, and that's what people want to hear about. And I think that, I mean, is that, do you agree with that, Sean?
Oh, yeah. In fact, it was funny, the home builders are so against it. We were talking with a firefighter from California who was the fire marshal in his jurisdiction, and he went up to build a new house, and he goes, you know, I want to put sprinklers in it. And the guy said, we don't offer that. He goes, well, give me someone who can. He goes, the builder refused to put residential sprinklers in his home. And he told the guy, he goes, if you have a problem, go blame the local fire marshal. He goes, I am the local fire marshal. You know,
just loads of misinformation.
Oh, yeah.
Misinformation out there.
And
it's really yelling. Go ahead.
The contractor will also tell you that they'll tell you that they carry a liability for the length of the term of the home, too, because the sprinklers will cause damage and I have to come back and rebuild the home, and it impacts my insurance. And I think that's one thing we've missed here a little bit today, too, Billy, is that there's national insurance companies that the fire service needs to partner with to get them to understand the impact that residential sprinklers will have on their investment.
It certainly makes sense, yeah. I mean, they're probably misinformed as well. And I mean, I've heard the stories of insurance companies that won't even take a stand on the issue.
Right.
And yeah. So where do we go from here? Well, maybe my brain is cooking away here. Maybe the answer is a summit where we pull the leadership together sooner than later. And I mean, I can imagine as a fire chief, if I was just given a 8 or 10 page binder that had all the questions and all the facts that I could hand to my elected officials along with a PowerPoint or a video. I know Ronnie Coleman, I mean, if you just get Ronnie on film and get him to tell some of the stories that he has told and the facts and the incredible presentation he did in Rochester, you can't help but listen and change your mind on this issue. So, Alan, final comments on this issue.
We have to seize the moment and don't let the moment control us. We've got to go after this. We can't back down from this. This is a life-saving measure that when I lay down at night on my pillow, I know we have done everything we can to protect my family that's asleep down the hallway.
Sean, Captain Sean DeCrane from Cleveland, comments, Sean, representing the IFF.
I think we need to get the information out sooner, because many of those individuals that are showing up to vote have their marching orders when they get there to vote. So we need to get the information, the education about the residential sprinkler issue out sooner than later. So when they get their marching orders, hopefully it's from an informed leadership.
Representative.
Who's telling them to vote for the residential sprinklers.
Chief K, Greg K, the new United States Fire Administrator, your thoughts, final thoughts, Greg.
Well, I think that there is a role for the United States Fire Administration to play as far as getting the facts out there and putting the information in, you know, in the fire service realm and in the builders for that matter, and letting them know, you know, here's what the facts are. I think it's a critical firefighter safety issue. I mean, as I said before, saving firefighters' lives is extremely important, and this is another tool in the toolbox to make that happen. One unnecessary loss of life is one too many.
You know, I just can't imagine after this conversation, I'm thinking this out while carrying on the conversation, but if we could pull off this summit, if we could get representation from the IAFF, representation from the National Association of State Fire Marshals, representation from the IAFC, coordinated through the United States Fire Administration to set this thing up in the next couple months. And, I mean, I just can't think that after a couple days of getting the great minds of our business together, we would not come out with one just absolutely fantastic document that would help communities turn these people around. Wouldn't you think?
I agree.
Would think so.
I agree.
Yeah, unbelievable.
I agree.
Well, listen, we've had on our show this week Chief Greg Cade, our new U.S. Fire Administrator. Greg, we welcome you to the new job, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Billy. Hopefully I'll get a chance to come back.
Absolutely. Chief Alan Schumann, Georgia State Fire Marshal, who sadly right now is the state fire marshal who recently responded a week ago to a line-of-duty death, actually earlier this week, where a firefighter was killed in a building that, if it had been sprinklered, odds are it wouldn't have happened. Alan, thanks for your work and for joining us as well today.
Thank you, Billy, and thanks for the thoughts and prayers for all our folks down here in Georgia.
It's a pleasure, and we certainly mean that. And Captain Sean DeCrane, Sean, almost 20 years on a job up in Cleveland, involved in firefighter training up there, but representing today the IAFF and the role they played in the International Code Council. And I think it was particularly important for you to be with us today, Sean, to make it very clear that the naysayers who were attempting to provide information that the IAFF was not in support of this issue was absolutely wrong. We sure appreciate you being here today as well.
Well, thank you for having me. I look forward to working with you in the future on this.
Appreciate that, and to all of you, thank you. You know, before you folks shut off your radios or put your CDs down or your DVDs or wherever you're listening to the show, just a couple quick words. At the bottom of the show is a link for you to purchase a DVD called And the Beat Goes On. It's a firefighter survival video that we put together. It's about 40-50 minutes worth of information, loaded with video, with clips, and lecture from a program I did a couple years ago at FDIC. This is a 100% fundraising effort, with 50% of the funds going to the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation and 50% of the funds going to the Chief Ray Downey Scholarship Fund. Please take a few seconds, click on the link, check it out. The video is like 20 or 30 bucks. It's not a lot of money, and it'll make a big difference not only to those two agencies, but also in your efforts to get your firefighters to help get it when it comes to the issues of firefighter safety and survival. And a reminder, Firehouse Expo is coming up July 24th to the 29th in Baltimore, Maryland. 5 days of education for firefighters, rescue personnel, and EMS members. The show hosts hundreds of companies for 3 days of exhibiting, loads of hands-on training, leadership programs, 150 instructors, 80 classroom sessions, 430 exhibitors. So we encourage you to come see us. We'll be doing a live broadcast of Through the Smoke there. We definitely have lined up Chief Sal Cassano from FDNY, who's going to be our guest on the show next, unless we do a broadcast between now and then, which we very well may do. And also consider joining us for our classroom program on Friday. We're doing a program called Firefighters and Fire Officers, Injury and Death, where I'm going to have two guests. One was a paramedic who was struck on the highway at over 70 miles an hour, and you're going to hear the story of how she survived and what her lessons were. And the other is a firefighter operating a tower ladder, and that tower ladder overturned while responding to a fire, as well as some very recent close calls and near-miss type information focused on firefighters being scared straight. You've been listening to Through the Smoke at RadioFirehouse.com. I'm your host, Billy Goldfeder. Again, thanks to our sponsors, First Responders Financial, our friend Dennis Smith, a longtime supporter of firefighters and a longtime firefighter, and the vice chair there at First Responders Financial, Pete Hayden, for their great support and support of the fire service as a whole. Thanks a lot. We'll see you soon.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.